All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments. With Mike Larson, we jumped around to a number of different sectors. In the back half of this show, as promised, we're going to focus more on the resource sector, and it seems like we're going to be focusing a lot on gold. We are chatting right now with Bernie DeGroot, Senior Investment Advisor at Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. Now, Bernie, there were a couple articles that you sent to your email list over the last week. You're very active sending out different reports, different analyst reports that you find relevant to the resource sector. Yeah, one on maybe the more short-term negative case for gold, but overall, the longer-term outlook for gold being still very much in this bullish environment, which, in all fairness, hey, the gold price keeps doing its part. I first want to start with that short-term negative where TD Security Senior Commodity Strategist Daniel Galli sent out a report that showed almost extreme long positioning by macro funds in gold. He wrote that these positions are now at the highest levels recorded since the depths of the pandemic. Also, we have seen some of these positions being reached during some of the more recent highs, September 2019, July 2016. Bernie, break down this article and how you view this fund positioning being long in the precious metals.
Well, good morning, Corey, and it's great to be back on a call with you again. And it's a very prescient timing here in the sense that there seems to be a lot more attention to it as we start to see the long-awaited Fed cuts start to happen. So, well, the market tends to be forward-looking here, and we're all anticipating these cuts. And when are they coming? When are they coming? We had talked like late last 2023 where they were saying, hey, there's going to be several cuts, and then the data changes and they push it out. So it's tough to get that actual realization of the rates cutting. But now that the rates are cutting, you're starting to see more and more of the expectations coming to fruition here. And when you look at, we had a great gold call this morning with Kerry McCurry, our gold analyst at Canaccord, did a wonderful presentation with some great data. And it just goes to show you not just the funds here, but the central bank buying for the last dozens of months here has been at record levels here. You're starting to see the appreciation of the gold price and all these different currencies, virtually all the currencies. So it's coming to the realization of what the expectation was. And I think people are getting more and more excited as you're starting to see that big job provision in the States, where it basically comes out that, hey, the 900,000 jobs or so that were created, well, those jobs actually weren't created when you look at the 12 months revised data where they realized that, oh, hey, those 880,000 jobs that we said were there, they actually weren't there.
Well, Bernie, considering the economic weakness that's starting to show up in some of the data, can you envision a scenario where possibly the U.S. general equity markets are maybe a bit over their skis if we are going to see a contraction in the economy? And would that help the precious metals diverge even further from general equities?
So, interesting point, Chad. And it's a couple of different things there. So, I mean, yeah, you look at a lot of these, the tech space and the broader markets, some of their multiples are looking at are at the, as you say, over the tips of their skis here. Whereas when you look at the multiples and some of these mining names, like, these things are trading at very, very low multiples, especially when you start to factor in that, hey, inflation is starting to subside a touch. And if you look at the margins that these mining companies are starting to print here, they're substantial. You saw some of the Q2 numbers were phenomenal. And I think the environment for this space in terms of gold moving higher, is it going to be bumpy? It most certainly is, as we're in an election year as well in the U.S., and it always is bumpy. But I think the broader markets are probably, they've had a good run here. When is that going to stop? I don't know, because I don't really speak to the specifics on the S&P. But if you look at where gold is right now, it's certainly, the equities are certainly lagging the commodities. And the goring piece that we talked about before as well, is like there's never been a time historically where gold and commodities have moved and the equities have not moved. It's just a matter of, do they move simultaneously? Is there a lag? And clearly there is a lag in this instance. And then the second question becomes, when does that lag catch up? It's tough to put pins in the calendar days, guys, but clearly you can see like the equities are appreciating. Are they where the people expect them to be or want them to be? No, because if you look at the 2020 gold price we had, we're still lagging a lot of those. But I think there's a lot of caution out there, and there's a lot of, I think, question marks in markets there in terms of with investors. Where do we put our money? That's the challenge I've seen.
So, Bernie, back to what Daniel Galli said here in this, as he called it, almost unanimously bullish position for gold and even visible short positions hovering near 10-year lows. How long in your eyes can we see action like this? And it's good to be in a bull market. I guess gold investors aren't really used to that, but how do you trade around this and how do you then carry it over to the stocks? Because it does seem like central banks, and now what Daniel Galli is saying, funds are bullish in the precious metals.
It's long overdue. And the challenge you run into here, Corey, is that the gold space is a very, very small space. And if you get some, like, I can't remember what the number was, whether it's 0.5% or 1%, you'd almost see $5,000 gold because the sector, generally speaking, is underinvested. You're going to have funds that are taking longer positions. But if you look at where it was in the last gold run, it is still lagging.
Well, let's dive into the equities a little bit further because obviously central banks don't buy gold equities. Some of the funds could, though, but in general, there's a lot less focus even on the desks that you see at Wall Street or Bay Street as far as commodities in general, much less the gold stocks. Do you think it's a situation where passive ETF investing brings in the inflows first and then they trickle down the food chain? Or do you think it's that we do see those better margins and that brings in more analysts?
Well, it always starts at the top. So the big names move, then we go down to the mid, then we go down to the junior. So you're starting to see some M&A. And in the past, you saw almost take unders in terms of there were no premiums. But if you look at, for example, Goldfield's premium on a Osisko, which was like a 62% premium to closing and say a 55% premium to the 20-day VWAP, you're starting to see some premiums because you're starting to see the majors start to get more interest. Like the call we had earlier, where Carrie was articulating that a lot of the majors have gold on their books at $1,300 an ounce because we still have, historically they're cautious. But if you start to see a little more activity or a little more sustained price in this range, you're going to see more confidence in the majors to be able to step out and participate in the M&A game.
We have seen some of the major stocks pretty much at all-time highs. Agnico Eagle has been on a run. There has been that percentage of large cap stocks and also some of the mid-tier miners doing very well. That money just hasn't filtered down to the juniors. Is this still all working out natural timing-wise in your eyes in terms of where the money's flowing?
Absolutely, Corey, you nailed it there. In terms of like some of these guys, like Agnico has really been executing extremely well, margins, their own internal growth, organic growth. So it doesn't just come in with a landslide. The early stages are selective, but when we do see the full bull run, when the market wants to get into the space, you're going to see this thing gap up for sure. It's just a matter of that. Historically, that's what it's always done. So the expectation is that when people want to get into more names. But right now you're clearly starting to see the haves and have nots. And as clients or as these corporate accounts start to build their positions or improve their stable of assets, you'll see that like IAM Gold starting to with Côté and stuff like that, things are starting to work out. So some of these bigger producers, as they bring on some of these assets like Equinox with Greenstone and stuff like that, that's a massive 400,000 ounce producer there in a safe jurisdiction in Canada. As you see these achieve commercial production and pops onto the balance sheet, you're going to see these guys get re-rated.
Well, for investors that are looking to get into the companies that could be the takeover targets, are you more animated by the development stage companies that have ounces in the ground or some of the single asset producers that could be bolt-on projects for these mid-tiers or larger companies?
It's challenging in terms of like one asset. Companies can have, they're more susceptible to hiccups versus a company with multiple assets is a much safer play because they've got revenue and production coming from multiple jurisdictions slash multiple mines. So that's always safer. So look, if you look, the biggest thing about mining is guys go scale. Like big mines have the same problems that small mines do, but the big mines have the upside that the smaller mines don't. So when you look at some of these names, like you look at like a Snowline where it's got like 6 million ounces in very early stages of drilling here, those are the unique unicorns out there. Look at Montage, for example. Like, again, 5 million plus ounces here. These are the assets that get the attentions of the majors. So you want to step into these bigger assets because there's not as many of them, and they're going to have way more upside, way more mine life, so that when the cycle starts to really go, it's got lots of reserves still left.
So you even mentioned something that we've been talking about is that this market is still full of the haves and the have-nots. About maybe 15-20% of the stocks are in that haves category where they can raise money. They've done pretty well share price wise. And then that 80+% that just haven't gotten any traction. Are you focusing your clients more on those stocks that have continued to perform fairly well?
Well, it's the same checklist that you look at, Corey, that we've done in the past in terms of like it's people, product, place, price, promotion. And mining is a really, really tough game. So when you can look at like the best example I'll give you is like look at the Lundin family, for example, with the third generation, you had Adolf, you got the late Lucas as well. And now the new generation is really coming into their own. And I mean, look at the successes they're having. Like it's just extremely impressive what they've done. And again, like mining is tough. So when you've got groups that have had repeat serial success stories, it's much safer to go into those names because these guys know what they're doing. They've got the financing network to be able to finance these things, and they've got experience because mining is not a short, easy game. It's extremely difficult, and it's just wonderful to see these success stories continue to move along. And you want to be selective. It's not the time where we're in a big bull market where the boats all get lifted by the tide coming in here. You still want to be selective because, as you commented, like you've seen some names like the Agnicos move and what have you there, but that's not the whole sector yet.
Are you looking forward at all to some of the optionality plays that maybe didn't look as attractive at lower metals prices, but with gold at all-time highs in the mid 2500s, almost every development project on the books looks good now. Some of those could see an increase just because of a re-rating. Are you looking at that angle at all?
Shad, we have all kinds of different risk profiles for clients. So that's a very torquey risk name, but for us, we want to look at bite size. So like your investments that you write big checks into are the nice safe names, and then just make sure with those torquey slash leverage names that your bite size reflects that. And if you're a younger person that's got more of a risk profile because you've got earning years in front of you, that might be something you take more of a risk on. But just you want to be realistic about your expectations as well. So I like to have more comfort in terms of getting into these serial success stories where you've got scale, scale, scale. And I mean, discoveries are tough, right?
Oh, they are tough, and they now even more so cost even more money to make happen. But Bernie, the big question being here, look, we've heard from a number of guests saying it's going to be the time for the juniors. We just need gold at 2,000, 2,200, 2,400, 2,500, and then more money flows into the sector. A lot of people are comparing this run to potentially what happened back in the 70s. But the thing is, back in the 70s, even back during the run after the great financial crisis, gold went 7x. Right now, you can argue gold has gone about 2x, a little bit more than that from the lows of now almost 8 years ago. Does gold just need to keep running higher up to the $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 level to bring in that money?
Corey, I don't think we need that. I think we just need to see more sustained pricing in these levels. I think gold is going to continue to trend higher just because you look at the indebtedness in the US, you look at China, for example, rolling out of their US treasuries into gold. So you're starting to see a move away from the US dollar. It's like, where does it go? And if you look historically, like when you look, went from the Dutch Empire to the UK Empire, then the US dollar for reserve currency, whenever you had those shifts in financial empires, there was a landing place that people were comfortable. Now, with the US dollar, there certainly seems to be an appetite to move away from it just because of the debt levels, et cetera. But where do you land? And that's a challenge. Are you going to go to the Russian ruble? There doesn't seem to be a lot of confidence there. Are you going to go to the yuan where you're pegged against the US dollars? Doesn't seem to be as much of an appetite there as well. So gold seems to be getting more and more attention because you're starting to see more and more interest. And I mean, if you look at the central bank buying, from 2011 compared to historical, like when they were selling for the prior, say, 2 decades. And if you look at from 2011 to now, and again, Carrie in our chart there's got a wonderful piece on that. It's very eye-catching. Like, it's staggering the amount of gold purchases by the central banks.
Bernie, just one more on the companies. I know I asked you about the higher torque optionality plays. Let me flip the script and go to the most conservative side, the royalty model. That's a great way to get fat margins too. Some of the royalty companies have way better margins than even the producers do because of the nature of their contracts. How do you feel about the positioning of royalty companies within one's portfolio?
I mean, it's a core position for us because, as you alluded to, Shad, I mean, when you look at an inflationary environment, like the royalty streamers, they always trade at higher multiples because they don't have exposure to inflation, what have you. So they've given the checks, quote unquote, earlier on, and now they're just collecting the ounces. Well, a lot of times, like I look at one of the guys we know well, the Sandstrom guys, they made the acquisitions with Nomad and what have you. Well, if you look at where the price of gold was then versus where it is now, it's extremely accretive. And a lot of times what you run into, like, where's your vision? If you've got a vision of a higher gold price, you want to write the check sooner rather than later. And when they wrote those with the acquisition with BaseCo and Nomad there, when you're looking at gold trading sub 2000, and now you see gold at 2500, well, look, that's a 25, 30, 40% accretion to where they had initially written the check.
So is the game then to look at these companies that have investments by major companies or by some of these major groups that have capital behind them?
I think it all depends, Corey, on your risk appetite. If you're a younger guy who really wants to have more torque and get into, say, the leveraged higher cost producers, as Shad alluded to, that might be your route. But it all depends on where you want to be, Corey. Like, I like to have exposure to some of that, but I'd rather be in the, but with big assets, right? You want to be, it's all about scale. There's that great book we talked about before by Norm Keevil on Never Rest on Your Oars, where tech was basically founded on these big assets that can withstand down cycles.
Bernie, what are your thoughts on gold stocks that also have a pretty big exposure to another metal? So gold stocks that have copper or silver, for example, do you like the diversification aspect or do you like more pure play gold stocks?
Well, Mother Nature kind of tells you what you're going to get there because it's tough to just find a pure copper play or to get the polymetallic deposit. So I just find with investors, people who are looking to get into precious metals aren't necessarily the same investors who like to step into copper. So if they happen to have both, that's great. But typically people are isolating on or dialing into the one specific either precious or industrial or what have you. Now you've got Mark Bristow with Barrick there. He's commenting, hey, like, we love gold and copper. And personally, I love that as well. I love the utilization of copper and the lack of replacement. You look at the whole world where we're going towards energy and the electrification of the world. It all goes through copper. You got to rewire the world, for lack of a better term. You can look at the lack of copper discovery we've made. There's a good piece interview there with Christy from First Quantum. He says, like, the Western world doesn't seem to have the appetite to step into discovering these copper plays versus other countries like China. They're more than happy to step into it because, again, the utility they have there is so much higher, and their appetite to get into these things are so much more than the Western world's, where the risk aversion and what have you is more common.
It's so true, though. The Western world still seems very much distracted by other sectors, other opportunities out there. But Bernie, it all sounds so positive, right? And we've heard this in the precious metals space before. We listen to precious metals commentators, those that are bullish in the sector, and they can always come up with good reasons to be bullish, especially when you point to debt levels and government and political and economic issues. But what are some of the risks that you see out there that you need to be aware of when you are managing portfolios, especially focused in commodities and precious metals?
There's so many factors to look at, Corey, in terms of where things are. But the biggest thing, like I talked about before, is that people, if you've got experienced mining people or mine creators, mine builders, they've seen a lot of these things and they know how to navigate them, or they have the financial stroke to be able to get through these things. But a lot of times the junior companies, when they come to they typically don't have the breadth to cover off, say, capital markets or geology. A lot of the junior companies just have geological familiarity, but when it comes to whether it's licensing or permitting issues or financing issues, they really don't know where to go, and they end up losing the asset, quite frankly. So if you can get a good experienced team, they know to cover off and check off all the boxes so they can navigate their way through this. But again, like the earlier geology was easier, like the outcrops, the easy stuff's all been found. So when you look at the oil and gas, where you've got disruptive technology like fracking and horizontal drilling, where you can go into old formations and you can get production. If you look at mining, like all the easy stuff, quote unquote, has been found. So now you've got to deal with more overburden, et cetera. And if you look at the geopolitical profile around the world, it's challenging. Like even when you look at the US of A, there's a lot of jurisdictions that just basically are no-goes. Like you look at some of the licensing and permitting purgatories that they've been put into, it's getting more and more challenging. Like it's the timeline is getting almost longer, not shorter, to license and permit stuff. So when you've got groups that are able to navigate the waters, they've got their community relations in there, that's very, very important.
Well, you brought up a couple big risks there, Bernie, with the jurisdiction, the permitting, being able to navigate social issues. What about the capital markets? Because a lot of the companies have suffered because we were in a stagnant market and they've diluted out their share count for so long that even if they have a good project, even if they have a good team, it's very difficult to raise money. How are you looking at, I guess, the haves and have-nots as far as the capital markets?
I think we've seen the delineation between the groups because the market has shown you. Like you look at, for example, like Montage, I'll revert back to, they were looking at raising 150 million, upsize it to 170 million. So when you get groups who have the financial stroke, the backer, they're getting backing versus everyone's got to learn somewhere, but it's tough. So you tend to see the bigger money follows the groups who've been there, done that, and they're able to net push these assets forward versus a lot of companies. They're going from one drill program to the next. A market sees they're going to need to raise money and they just don't have it. So when the market gets moving here, you're going to see a lot more participation, but we're still in the earlier stages, which as an investor, it's Goring said, hey, there's a cost to being early and you'd rather be early than late. And some people don't have that same investable horizon. Like, where do you want to be? So for ourselves, like, look, it's really tough to get timelines. So we always want to be able to hold the trade, and that's where we're at in terms of like, if you don't have some patient money, we really don't want to see you stepping into it. Because I get people saying, "Hey, Bernie, where can I park money for 6 months?" Well, if you want to park money for 6 months, I wouldn't be putting it into the mining space because we have comfort in where we expect it to go. It's just when does it get there?
Oh, isn't that the case, right? Because look, some people probably entered a few years ago and have ridden it lower and lower. But if you can time it right and you do have that longer term horizon, which unfortunately markets have shifted a little bit away from, you can make some money there. And this could be early stages. But Bernie, just to wrap it up then, as much as we say we need other investors to come into the sector, do we need more leadership from the major miners then to distribute some of the capital that they're making and support more of these projects?
I think that's just a natural evolution. When they get more confidence to say, hey, are we staying here? Because look at things are volatile, the horizons are uncertain here, but you're starting to see more and more M&A. And I think it's going to continue here because now Q2 is really good, Q3 is looking solid. So as the majors, they've all got different risk profiles. Bigger companies are more bureaucratic, it's tough to get more sign-off, et cetera. But as you see more stabilization here with pricing, I think you're going to see more M&A. But I think you're going to see some of the really sharp companies who are nimble, who can move stuff, like I alluded to before with Sandstorm, when they made those acquisitions with Nomad and BaseCo. The market's probably like, hey, what are you guys doing here? This is a lot of stuff to bite off. Well, if you look now, backward looking here, those were brilliant acquisitions because, again, look where the price of gold was then versus where it is now.
All right, Bernie, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time with us on this weekend show. Again, Bernie DeGroot, Senior Investment Advisor, Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. It's great having you on the show, Bernie. And everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, and our podcast or YouTube channel. Just search DKE Report to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates we recorded from the week. Bernie, thank you very much for your time. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.